from 9to5 Mag. This is Stack Trace. I'm your host, Guy Rambo, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, John Sandel. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rambo?
I'm doing great as well. So what have you been up to?
Yeah, I've been pretty busy lately. As we talked about on the previous episode, I've now been indie, like, you know, pretty much full-time indie for almost 2 months. And one big challenge for me during these kind of 2 months has been priorities. Like, what do I focus my time on? And so I've been running some experiments lately on trying to make myself more organized around my work. So I think I might have talked about this on the show before, that I was mostly using Apple Notes to like organize everything from like, you know, podcasts to upcoming articles, and everything went into Apple Notes. It was just one big kind of collection of ideas and stuff. And I still love to use that kind of very freeform format for note-taking and for ideas. But I've started using reminders quite a lot, and I actually use Hey Dingus to schedule reminders. And I say like, hey, remind me to reply to this email in 2 hours if I'm busy with something, but I want to reply to that email as quick as possible. Or remind me to write this article tomorrow or something like that. And by getting these ideas or things I know I need to do kind of out of my head, and just, you know, I tell them to my computer or to my phone, and that's it. I don't have to worry about it anymore. That has really been like a very big improvement for me in terms of just productivity and getting organized.
I like to compare this stuff with RAM memory.
Right. Yeah, that's a good analogy.
It's like if you keep having to remember stuff, like basic stuff, like, oh, I have to pay the bills and I have to do the laundry and whatever, you fill up your brain's RAM with that stuff, and then you end up stressed out and you don't even know why, but it's because you have all of this stuff going on that you have to remember. And yeah, if you put that away in it can be like a note in your fridge, or it can be reminders, which is what I use as well. I use Hey Dingus as well for reminders. Yeah. If you can do that, you forget about it and you get reminded, which is what technology is good for. So yeah, I definitely recommend that approach. And I've been doing that for a really long time because I can never remember anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, getting things out of my head and, you know, like you say, to be able to clear the RAM for the task at hand is really, really nice. And it lets me focus more on the task at hand, because one thing that I'm doing this year, like for the past 2 months, is I'm working on many more things. Like I have more kinds of articles that I'm writing on my site. You know, I've done even more podcasting and new things as well. And I have some new projects in the works. And I'm also at the same time building my new website. So there's a lot of things going on. And in between, you know, talking to sponsors and answering questions from people and all these kind of things, like, you know, it can easily pile up. And yeah, getting a little bit more organized and using reminders and stuff for that has been really, really great. So I'm continuing to kind of fine-tune my productivity and see if I can, you know, get even more out of the time that I have.
Yeah, do not underestimate the admin stuff you have to do if you're indie.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been kind of a big surprise for me. I guess I could have anticipated it, but, you know, it turns out that when you have to communicate with a lot of people, that takes a lot of time. And it's something that I really enjoy doing. So I tweeted about it like a week or so ago that you know, the admin time has been growing quite a lot. And, you know, some people suggested that, you know, why don't you hire someone for this? And, well, first of all, wow, I don't really have that kind of money. but the second part is that I really enjoy like talking to sponsors. I enjoy answering questions from people and things like that. And, you know, it's not something that I would, you know, want someone else really to do. It's more about, you know, finding a way to do all of those things while still like producing content, coding, you know, pretty much like, you know, being able to time box things and being able to focus on the task at hand, you know, what I'm doing at the moment. So what about you? What have you been up to?
So I am now part-time at my day job. So I am
semi-indie.
Semi-indie, yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
So it's been going very well. I had a little bit of a vacation last week, so I'm relaxed. And I am advancing with Chibi Studio 2.0, which hopefully should be in a shippable state soon-ish. Been working on the settings screen lately, as you've seen.
Oh, yeah.
Did you like the settings screen?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. I love the way maybe you can put, like, in the artwork of the current chapter, like a screenshot, because so people can see it, because I really like the design you went for with the grouping of the cells that you have there. It was very, very nice the way, like, you had, like, a thin border around each group of table view cells and then the title on top and the description. It was like a grouped... it was almost like a modern take of the pre-iOS 7 group table view style, if you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
where yeah. you had this more, like, boxed-in cells. I really liked that. That design was very, very nice.
Yes, and I am inspired by the new design of the wallet app on iOS 12.2. I suspect that's going to be more common going forward, maybe in iOS 13. That's going to be like the default for grouped cell styles.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just something the wallet team decided to do, and I found it cool and I decided to replicate it a little bit in my app. But also, one thing I did, which they haven't, at least not publicly, is I have a dark mode as well, which
oh,
is
yeah.
kind of cool.
Very cool.
So yeah, I've been working on that, and it may sound silly, like, oh, it's just a setting screen, but it's like Steve Jobs used to say, and it's not his original phrasing, but like you need to care about what people don't see, and in this case, the setting screen people will see, and it's important for it to match the style of the app and to be a good platform citizen and to be usable and pretty as well. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we've all been there, you know, you're using an app and then you press settings and you get kicked out to like a website or something, or it's very clear that what's being rendered on the screen right now is a web view, right? It has like completely different styling, like it's not very responsive or for some reason.
Or it's just like a vanilla table view.
Yeah, exactly. And this kind of attention to detail that you're showing there, it also shows that you really care about the app, and it's not only about, you know, putting like nice bells and whistles, you know, in the most used screens, but also like really making a good design throughout the app.
Yep. And yeah, I've done some more tweaks to some animation stuff, which I love, and I spent way too much time with. so yeah, that's what I've been up to. And I'm also working on an update to AirBuddy with some much awaited bug fixes and some new features as well.
Nice. Looking forward to seeing that. Yeah, I've been using AirBuddy quite a lot, actually. It's gotten me to use my AirPods much, much more when I'm at home, because I have a set of headphones that I usually use when I'm in front of the computer. But being able to now, like, super easily switch, like, for example, if I'm out on a walk and I have my AirPods and I sit down in front of my desk, I can just, you know, pretty much click one button in AirBuddy, and then I can continue listening on the Mac, which is just, you know, it's really, really great.
Did it make you use the Notification Center?
No, not that much, to be honest. I have looked at that view a few times, but it's mostly been like that main panel that shows up when you have your AirPods closed that lets you connect. That's mostly the UI I've been using.
Yeah, I've been using the Notification Center widget a lot myself to like check on the state of my devices and also to connect. Some people don't know this, but if you click the AirPods in that Notification Center widget from AirBuddy, you can connect to them just like you can with the popover window. So that's a little pro tip, pro AirBuddy tip for you.
Nice.
And I love that. And since the little status windows, it can take a while for it to show up sometimes because there's a lot of stuff that goes on before it can show up. So if I'm in a hurry, I just put AirPods on my ears and swipe quickly and just connect. Or if I've been using them with my iPhone, in which case the status window won't show. But I'm actually working on some new features which will make it possible for you to like trigger the little status window to open manually if you have your like AirPods on your ears and you just want to connect quickly. You can like press a keyboard shortcut and do that, or use a menu bar icon. So there are some things in the works.
Nice.
Sneak peek for you.
Sounds awesome. Yeah, really exciting.
And speaking of indie life, we have some follow-up about last episode, right?
Yeah, exactly. We got a message after our last episode from a guy called Marcos, and he wanted us to talk a little bit more about marketing for indie developers. So we thought we could expand this into more like a proper topic. And what Marcos said was, it seems to me that having a consistent media coverage for an app or for any kind of indie product is essential. So I would like to ask you what you think is the best approach on this. Do I actively have to go to like blogs and influencers or writers and let them know about the product I'm building? Or should I just focus on building a good product and when the time is right, it will be noticed? So I think personally, this is a super interesting topic. And I think it's also a tricky one because, you know, sometimes it can feel a little bit as developers, like it can feel almost like marketing is like a dirty word. And you know, you should just focus on building the app. And if you build a great app, then people will love it and they will use it and they will be successful. And that's not necessarily true. And neither is the opposite either. Like you can't really take a bad app and just throw a bunch of marketing and it will be successful. I mean, again, maybe you can. There are, of course, examples and counterexamples everywhere. But generally speaking, I would say it's like you kind of need to do both. Like you both need to build a really good product and you need to do, you know, good marketing in order to get people to notice your product and to use your product and to check it out. So I thought it would be interesting just to talk a little bit about that. And like, if we have some tips on, you know, how to reach out to people, how to get people interested in something and how to kind of market something that you've built yourself. So what do you think about this, Rambo?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, marketing is a really important aspect of app development, especially if you're an indie developer. I mean, if you are working for a company, there's usually a whole department that's going to take care of it. But if you want to, like, even if it's just a side project and you want it to be successful, you will have to do marketing. And for me, marketing starts even before a single line of code has been written. Right. If you are planning on building a product, you should think about how you're going to market the product even before the product is even in development. So which features are going to be the most desirable for my users? What's the target market for this app? And then after that, you can start thinking about which publications write about similar stuff. Do I know any, and I, by know, I don't mean knowing personally, I mean like knowing right. from the internet. Do I know some like quote unquote famous Twitter person that might be interested in writing about this or anything like that? So yeah, I feel like marketing is really important. And to what you said about making a good product, people usually say like good products market themselves,
right?
And that is true, but that doesn't mean that they market themselves as in like just by being good you have marketing. It means like you have less work to do to market the product if it's really good. Like I can give you an example, and by giving this example I'm actually gonna be marketing a product here.
Nice, very meta.
So today it came to my knowledge about the existence of a new app. It's called I think it's a Soor that you pronounce it. It's Soor, and it's basically a client for Apple Music. And someone posted about it on a Slack, I saw the app. And like when you post something to Slack, there's the little snippet from the website. And there was this beautiful screenshot of the app. And that caught my attention. And I opened the website, and it's a beautiful website with an amazing demo video of the app. And the app has some cool new gestures I've never seen before. And so that got me extremely excited about the app. So I went after the developer, and they gave me access to the test flight. And I'm going to write about the app on 9to5 Mac when it comes out next week.
That's perfect.
So that's the story of how I never heard about the developer of this app. I don't know if he's well known in other circles, but I never heard of him. And he made a great product, and he was basically posting about it on Twitter and sending it to some people he knows. And it ended up appearing to me on Slack feeds, and now I'm going to write about it. So it's an example of like a good product that markets itself in, as in it's a beautiful product and it's interesting, but the person behind the product had to do work to get it to people.
Yeah, absolutely. You almost always need some form of bootstrapping, whether that's a like super nice website with a great video, whether that is, you know, something that people would like to share and, you know, in this case, post it on Slack and you saw it, etc. Because what you're trying to do really is reach some kind of quote unquote network effect where, you know, the thing you've been building is really good, and the only goal you have with the marketing is really only to make people aware of it. That doesn't mean that you have to become like a salesperson or that you have to like, you know, pretend that the app is something it's not, or, you know, oversell it or something like that. It's only about like really showing what is good about this thing and doing it in a very direct, clear manner. Because one thing also that I've seen kind of from marketing mistakes, if you will, is that the marketing will just be too verbose. Like, there will be too much. There will be, like, too many things. And, you know, then it's also harder to understand what is this thing really trying to do. So I think, like, really keeping things focused and, like, bootstrapping that in a way. And another way to do that, especially if you want to market something to other developers or you want to get other developers excited about something, can also be to share a bit about kind of behind the scenes of how you built this thing. So regardless of which app you're building, chances are pretty high that there's something interesting there, like something you're excited about, something cool that you had to solve, you know, to share more about that, because that can also get people excited about the app to check it out because, you know, they want to learn more about this thing that you built.
Yes, and if you would like to get actual like press coverage, it's actually in theory simple. You just have to find out a contact for the website. Most news sites, blogs about Apple and apps and stuff, they have public email addresses you can send stuff to. Those addresses are monitored by usually the entire team of the website. Also, individual writers have their own email addresses. Mine is rambo@9to5mac.com. Feel free to send cool apps to me. So you find that out. Just use Google, visit the websites. And it's usually useful to like find someone at that website who's written about something similar before.
Right.
So because that means that individual writer or editor or something is interested in that type of content.
Yeah, and this kind of outreach that you're talking about, like when you're actively emailing specific people, I think it's very, very important when you do that to also, to your point, to do a little bit of research first. Like, don't just cold email people with the same, like, you know, text that you would email to like 1,000 people, because usually that won't be very interesting to the person receiving it. You know, it feels almost a little bit like spam. Like if you just get an email that says, hey, I made this app, can you please retweet this? Or, hey, I made this app, can you write about this? Like if there's no other, if there's no other text, no other explanation than that, then chances are very, very low that this person will actually go ahead and check that app out and actually write about it. So one really good point here, I think, and one cool example would be to just compare the difference between you and me, Rambo, because we both are writers, we both write on websites, but the things that we cover is very different. So for example, if you wanted to market an app, it would be much, much better to reach out to you than to me, because yes, I don't cover apps. Like I write about Swift, right? Like that's what I do. So sometimes I will get emails from people and, you know, DMs and stuff that will say, hey, I made this app, can you please write an article about it? And that's again, one of those, like, it feels like one of those copy pasted emails, because that feels almost like, well, have you even checked out my site? You know, like I don't write about apps, right? So I think it's very good to do that research and not just, you know, mass email, but to really take the time to sit down and, you know, like you said, check out like what has this person written about before? What could be the thing that would make this journalist or this person interested in the product that I've been building, and how can I kind of quote unquote sell it to them? So I think that would be my kind of biggest advice about this, is to not act like, you know, anyone will automatically always share your stuff, but to more kind of like show them a convincing story about why this is worth kind of covering.
Yeah, and you mentioned who would be more appropriate to contact. Like, that depends much on the context. Like, if you are, let's say you're making like a really cool new developer tool for iPad or something.
Right.
Then maybe you should write John and let him know, because
yeah,
then
please do.
He's going to get excited about it and tweet about it and maybe even write about it. So and that's something you would not like send to my 9to5 Mac email, because 9to5 Mac in general does not write about developer tools unless like they're like hugely popular, like Xcode or something. But you could send that to me as well, like on Twitter or something, because then I can tweet about it. So you always have to think about the context and what's the target market for what you're trying to market.
Yeah, totally. And another thing that I think is just worth bringing up here is, you know, it's easy when you hear the two of us talk about this to think, oh, you know, John and Rambo talking about marketing stuff. They have it so easy. They have a podcast. They have websites. They're, you know, Rambo's writing for 9to5 Mac. It's so easy for us, right? We can just post on our websites about something and it will immediately be successful. And that's, number one, definitely not true. And I wanted to bring up, like, probably what I think is the best example of this, and that is the app Vesper. Which, if you remember, was an app that was built by John Gruber, Brent Simmons, and Dave Wiskus. So, like, a really, like, all-star team. And yeah, they built this note-taking app, which I really loved. Like, I got it pretty much when it came out. I really loved it. But they shut it down after, like, a few years. It didn't work out for them. And John Gruber wrote a really, really good piece about, like, what he thought went wrong and, like, what they would do differently, like, you know, given a chance to do it again. So it kind of ties back to what I said earlier, which is, you know, having an audience to talk to, it's not enough. Like, you also need a really good product. For example, also just on this show, like, we tried to do a Patreon and that didn't work out for us, you know, even though we have quite a lot of listeners who are listening to the show. And again, that's not strange or anything. Like, these things happen, and sometimes plans work out, sometimes they don't. And I think it's just important to remember that, you know, just because you get access to some kind of coverage, whether that is, you know, your own audience or through someone else, doesn't necessarily mean that you will be successful with something. You also need, you know, a really, really good product that people want to use. And you need also the right, you know, setup and approach, because even though Vesper, in this case that I brought up as an example, was a really good product, it was more like the strategy and how they rolled it out that they, you know, in retrospect, you know, figured out that that could have been better. And yeah, it's just that, you know, marketing and selling something and getting something successful is just a really, really complex, big piece of machinery with many moving parts. And it's just important to kind of focus on all of those moving parts rather than just one of them.
Yes, exactly.
Great. So next up, we're going to do another one of our delayed reviews. That is what we do here on the show. We don't get review units, right? So we're doing reviews like 1 year after. But this time, it's not 1 year after. It's only actually a few months after this product was announced. And that is the iPhone XR. So Rambo, you have an iPhone XR. So what do you think about this device? Like, give us your review of the iPhone XR.
Yes, I do have an iPhone XR, as I do many others, and I should go to iPhones Anonymous or something, because I have an iPhone purchasing problem, I think.
I think you do, yeah.
Yes, so one can never have too many test devices, that's my excuse.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. So I have an iPhone XR, a red one, because why not? It's red, it's beautiful. And yeah, I've been trying it out, and I can start with the TLDR, which is, it's an amazing iPhone.
Nice.
Yeah, so the screen size is great. It's bigger than the XS, and being a liquid retina display and not an OLED display, it does make a difference, of course, but it's such a good LCD that I would not be unhappy to have it as my only device. My daily driver is the XS Max. Still, I'm not switching. This is mostly a test device, but using it as my main device for a while, I was fine with the screen. I didn't really have any issues with it. Face ID works perfectly, just like on the other iPhone. Also, the camera. I need to talk about the camera. So,
oh, yeah?
You think like, oh, it's the quote-unquote cheap iPhone.
Right.
It has only one camera. And so what can I do with this camera? So Apple implemented a version of portrait mode that only works for people. It uses some machine learning stuff to separate a person from the background. But there's this magical app called Halide.
Oh, yeah.
Which. And so I have Halide. I've been basically using it as my iPhone camera. I don't even open the built-in camera anymore. And I have it set up to take raw photos, and I edit them on Darkroom after I take them. If you
such a pro.
Yeah. If you check out my Instagram, you can see some of the pictures I've been taking. Some of them are with the XS Max, others with the XR. So Halide, when I mentioned it to you, you mentioned like you would need to learn all of the settings and stuff. But even though it is like a pro camera for iPhone and it has all the knobs you can tweak, it does have like an automatic mode, which is the one I use.
The one I've been using mostly as well. But it's kind of for me, when I'm using Halide, I also like to tweak with those parameters because I am definitely not a photographer. And my girlfriend is actually a photographer, but I'm not. And I've been just trying to learn a little bit. And Halide has been like a really great way to do that because it's extremely visual, right? Like when I increase the exposure or some other parameter, like I can instantly see the result. And that's kind of what I like about that app. So I think that's why I said that to you is like, you know, I use Halide when I have a little bit more time to take a photo and when I want to play around with those things. But my daily camera is still like the iPhone's default camera app because I just swipe on the lock screen to access it and I take a photo. Because when I take photos, it's not so much like an artistic endeavor. It's more like, I'm in front of this building and it looks pretty. Okay, photo, done. Let's move on.
Yeah, so I've worked with video before, so I do know a little bit about ISO and aperture and shutter speed and stuff like that. But on my iPhone, I don't really want to be tweaking that stuff. So I do it in post, basically. I take
Let's
the picture.
Let's fix it in post.
Exactly.
Just like this show.
Yeah. So I take the picture and then I send it to Darkroom and I edit it there. So I take them in a raw mode and I tried out the portrait mode on Halide. And the voodoo magic they do is that you can, with an iPhone XR, with a single back camera, take portrait mode pictures of anything. Not only people, like the built-in camera. So I've tried it with a dog and with plants and flowers and stuff. And it is amazing. Like it's better than what I can do with the built-in camera on my XS Max, really. It's really that good.
Yeah, and this is something I think I mentioned last episode as well, that I spoke to Ben Sandowski, who built Halide, or who is the programmer behind Halide, about this on Swift by Sundell. And one thing that I also mentioned to him there on that episode was, I think a big reason, and also this actually ties back to our marketing segment earlier, and a big reason that I think that Halide has been so successful is because they've been extremely good at building specific features for specific hardware. So for example, when the iPhone X was just about to launch, this is coming full circle now because Ben actually said on my show that he used the tip from you when you discovered, you know, the glyph for the iPhone X that it was going to have a notch. Then they immediately started working on a UI to fit that, that kind of hardware design. And the same is true here now for this like very specific portrait mode for the XR. And I think that's another approach when it comes to like, you know, building really successful product is to really have that attention to detail and build specific features for specific hardware, which, you know, gets people excited, right?
That's also a recipe to get featured by Apple.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If you adopt new features, especially of new hardware on day one, you do a good job, of course, you have a good chance of being featured by Apple. They love this stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any questions about the iPhone XR? I mean, what I've liked the most so far is the camera. It's great. And also the fact that it's a bigger iPhone, but it's not as big as the XS Max.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about assets. So the iPhone XR is a 2x screen, right?
Yep.
Which means that 2x assets will be used on it, but it's also a much larger display. So do you think that as developers, we need to take any kind of specific consideration, apart from kind of the halide strategy of building something specific for it, but just in terms of the UI, have you noticed any apps that, you know, actually tweak the UI for the iPhone XR because of the, you know, resolution size kind of difference between that and the normal 10?
I haven't noticed anything like that. For like UI stuff on Chibi Studio, which I've been testing on the iPhone XR extensively, it's become like my main test device. I use vector assets, PDFs basically, and also Core Animation Archives.
Vector stuff.
Yeah, so I haven't noticed anything. What I do a lot in Chibi Studio is I have lots of one pixel lines for like borders and stuff.
Right.
Because if you like specify a border size of one on UIKit, it's going to be like 2 pixels on iPhone XR and 3 on iPhone XS Max.
Exactly, one point.
Yeah, so you have to like divide it by the screen scale to get a 1 pixel line. I noticed that those work normally on iPhone XR. The only like tweak I had to do, which I've done for all devices with a notch or with ears, as Apple likes to call them.
Right.
I had to, because when you enter the editor, I put buttons in the ears, so to either side of the notch, and to center those buttons inside the ear, I had to like give specific offsets for like iPhone XR, iPhone XS, and iPhone XS Max, because the size of the ears is a little bit different.
You know, that thing you just said, like taken out of context, would be so funny. You know, I'm putting buttons in my ears. Yeah, that sounds like a smart move. It's good to hear that even like thin lines, because that's something that could cause like a little bit of flickering on especially older devices, I guess. But it's good to hear that even though, you know, it is a larger display and it has 2x screen, that, you know, even these like hairlines or whatever you want to call them, like these very, very thin borders work well as well.
Yeah. The only thing I noticed, like if you have it flat on a table, you can see a little bit of like kind of like a shadow around the notch. Probably because of the masking they have to do for the LCD screen. But that's like really nitpicky. You can't really see it when you're using the device. It's only like if you're looking at it from an angle.
Right.
That's like the only, if you can call it a downside of the notch plus an LCD screen that I noticed.
Yeah. Well, it sounds really, really good. I'm happy you're happy with the phone, but we really need to do something about your iPhone purchasing addiction.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead now and move on to our next topic. We want to talk about some new Mac rumors that have come out recently. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's first sponsor, which is our good friends at Hyper. Now, we talked on the previous episode about Hyper's new Hyperjuice wireless charging case for AirPods. And the good news is that this deal is still available, because at 9to5Mac, we've teamed up with Hyper to form a deal of the month where you can get a really, really good deal on this product. So the Hyperjuice wireless charger is a new and second generation of this product, and it features a fully enclosed design and lots of other improvements. So how it works is that you just take your normal AirPods charging case that you get with the AirPods, and you just insert it right into the Hyperjuice case, and that enables you to wirelessly charge it on any Qi charger of 5 watts and above. So you can just take your Hyperjuice that contains the AirPods charging case inside of it, place it on a wireless charger, and boom, you can now charge your AirPods wirelessly. Super cool. And the good thing is that this Hyperjuice charging case also has a design and look that looks similar to the original case that comes with the AirPods. And it charges the AirPods back in full in just 1.5 hours. And there's even a little green LED light that will let you keep an eye on the current charging status. So for all readers of 9to5 Mac and listeners of Stacktrace, we have a really great special offer on Hyperjuice, which gives you 60% off the normal price. So you just pay $20 for all listeners of this show. To take advantage of this great offer and to get your AirPods charging wirelessly, head over to the show notes for this episode, which you can find in your podcast player. There's going to be a link there to get this offer for Hyper's Hyperjuice wireless charging case for AirPods. Thank you so much to Hyper for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. So Rambo, there has been some new rumors about the Mac. So tell us what has been going on.
Yes, I love rumors about Macs because I love Macs and I always want new and cool Macs. So there have been some new rumors. These come from Min-Chi Kuo, analyst, and we reported about this report which he put out. And I picked like the two most interesting aspects about the Mac, which I think we should talk about. And the first one is he mentions that Apple is planning a new MacBook Pro, which will be between 16 and 16.5 inches. Yeah. What do you think about that, John?
I think that's super cool because I know a lot of people who have said that they miss the old 17-inch computer. And, you know, when I hear this, in the beginning, I was a little bit surprised. Like, who wants a laptop that's that big? You know, that sounds kind of impractical. But then I also think about it, and a lot of people, they mostly use their laptop, for example, in their office. And they need to have a laptop because, you know, they go to meetings and they work maybe from different desks and stuff like that. But they want to have the most screen real estate. So for those users that can be, you know, developers or designers or video and audio editors, like anyone who wants a lot of screen real estate, and, you know, as developers, we know this very well that, you know, the more screen space we can have for Xcode and the simulator and all those things, like the better it is. So I'm actually pretty excited about this rumor, even though I personally love small computers, I would probably never buy one of these, but I can totally see like why this is something Apple might be planning, especially if they are going to achieve it by kind of thinning the bezels even more and kind of doing the same thing that they did with the iPad of, you know, making the screen bigger, but just, you know, making the overall package kind of smaller.
You know who would buy this?
You would.
Of course I would.
So why is that? Why would you buy a product like this?
Yeah, so I like having the biggest laptop screen I can within limits, of course. Like not like a
55-inch laptop.
Yeah. So it sounds really appealing to me, especially if we consider the possibility that this will not increase the size of the device itself.
Right.
Then it's a no-brainer for me because I already use a 15-inch MacBook Pro. I do have the 13-inch one, which I do use when I need like extra mobility, like when I'm traveling internationally and stuff. And that's your fault, by the way. You know that.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so I do like having the option to have like an extra mobile device that I can use like when I'm giving talks and stuff like that. But when I'm at home and going to the office and changing desks at the office and going to meetings and stuff, a 15-inch MacBook Pro is perfectly mobile enough for me. It is a little bit heavier and a little bit thicker and a little bit bigger than the 13-inch, but it's not that bad. And I have a backpack I can use to carry it around. So yeah, it's fine. So if they do release this, I'm definitely going to get it because a bigger screen is always good. Now we should speculate what would this look like, because Cole also said that they are going to feature an all-new design. What does an all-new design mean for a MacBook Pro these days?
Well, if we're going to look at the history of changes, it would be thinner and lighter, right? Probably with some pretty creative solutions when it comes to things like heat management and, you know, processor architecture and management and things like that. And, you know, this has also got me thinking that maybe this also is tied into the rumors of ARM Max, because let's say that this new MacBook Pro with 16 inches or something like that would be an ARM computer, for, you know, just for the sake of argument. That could probably enable Apple to make it a lot thinner and maybe not have, like, completely fanless, but maybe have a smaller fan and those kind of things that could enable them to, you know, squeeze more things into the actual computer.
Yeah, this will probably not be an ARM Mac, but it's interesting to think about the possibilities when they do move everything to their own processors.
Yeah.
Which we will talk about a little bit more later. But what I was thinking was, like, imagine the iPad Pro, but as a laptop. Wouldn't
right.
that be a cool design?
So you mean like that the screen of the computer would look exactly like the new iPad Pro, but then that there would be like an hinge, like, and an actual keyboard, not like the smart keyboard and things like that.
Yeah, like two iPads glued together with a hinge.
But not just with glass. Like, you would still have a physical keyboard, right?
Yes, I do think and hope this is as a physical keyboard. What I was thinking was, like, these generation of keyboards, they are problematic. Like, there's no denying that.
Yeah.
I do love the feel of the keyboard, and I do genuinely like the keyboard. I even don't mind the touch bar, as many people seem to do, but I'm fine with it. It's not the best thing ever, but it's cool, and I use it. But there are issues with this keyboard design, and it does start failing after a while, and it seems to be like a widespread issue. Maybe it got a little bit better with the 2018 design, but not that much. So what I was thinking is, I am super happy with the Smart Keyboard Folio design and the feel of the keys and everything.
Yeah, I love that keyboard. It's super great.
Yeah, and those are completely sealed. So
yeah.
You can, like, I mean, I'm not going to try it, but I bet you could, like, drop a glass of wine on that thing and it wouldn't break, because there's no way for the liquid
to get
in. You
just soak it up.
In.
You can just wipe the wine off the, you know, you can just use it as a cloth. Well, don't try this at home. Don't try this at home.
Yeah. We are not responsible for that. I think maybe they could come up with something like that. Doesn't the Microsoft Surface have like a, I mean, they went a little bit overboard with like a cloth, something like that. It's like fluffy.
Yeah, there's been a lot of these creative designs for tablets to make the keyboards both be like soft, because you also want it to act like a cover for the actual tablet, like the smart mm-hmm. keyboard does, but also be a good keyboard. And I must say, like, you know, I've used the iPad more and more, you know, as I've talked about on the show, and it's become my travel computer. Like, in my last trip that I took, which was over 2 weeks long, I didn't even bring my computer at all. And I was very, very happy with the iPad keyboard, the smart keyboard, because to your point, like, I don't have to be constantly worried. Like, when I was traveling, I was, you know, going to like the beach, and I was staying in a jungle, and, you know, I didn't have to worry about like, oh, will I get sand into my laptop keyboard, like, because I got some sand actually on that keyboard, but I just brushed it off. You know, it was like good as new. And I think that's a super cool quality of this keyboard, just like that it makes the product feel more like resilient to dirt and to these things that, you know, even though you might not be bringing like your laptop to the beach, or you might not be, you know, eating a sandwich over your laptop, but a lot of people do, you know, there's dirt everywhere, and it's just nice not to have to worry about things getting into the keyboard. And this sealed off design, like you say, like that the keys are completely sealed. I think that's just a very nice quality of a keyboard.
Yep. So let's see if they do like a fluffy keyboard or a sealed keyboard. There are many options there, and I would like to see the keyboard change in a significant way that makes it more reliable, please.
I just want the Johnny Ive video where he calls it the fluffy keyboard. I just want that to be the official name.
Yeah, it's the fluffiest keyboard we ever made.
Oh, yeah. So apart from a new potential MacBook Pro model, there's also been some rumors about, or new rumors, I should say, you know, there's been rumors for a while, and Apple has even at some point actually said and confirmed that they are working on a Pro display. So this new information or rumor is that there's a 6K display in the works.
Yes, that's very interesting. He mentioned that this new 6K display would feature a new mini LED technology, which is not to be confused with micro LED. It's a different technology.
It's like mini USB and micro USB.
Exactly. But it would allow for outstanding picture quality.
Nice. Well, that sounds like another thing they could say in the video, right? It's outstanding picture quality. And does
and
this
gorgeous.
Mean that... Yeah, oh yeah. Does this mean also, like, I guess that you would have a higher pixel density, like more like a retina kind of display, but not so far as with micro LED technology, which also micro LED has to do with, like, the black levels and things like that, right? Where you can get more deeper blacks, almost like OLED. But this would be more like about the density of the pixels?
From what I've read about it, it's like... It's kind of in the direction of micro LED, so it's like an in-between between LED and micro LED. So it would allow for greater contrast ratio, closer to what OLED can give you, but not as good as micro LED.
Right, okay. So a 6K display, like what kind of size do you think we're talking about?
The report mentions that it would be a 31-inch display.
31 inches. All right.
Yes.
That's quite a big display.
Yeah, and our friends at 95Mac, I think Jeff and Stieber, they made some concepts of both this supposed MacBook Pro and this new display, and we can put the images in the chapter and link in the show notes. Those are very interesting renders they made.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about this product? Is that something that you would buy as well? Like a 6K display?
Nah, it would probably be too expensive. And I mentioned before that I like having the same setup everywhere. So I don't use like my laptop in clamshell mode with an external monitor display, keyboard and everything. So I just use my laptop as is. Because I like having a stable setup that's always the same, that doesn't change. And by stable, I also mean that macOS is pretty terrible at handling external displays still.
Yeah, especially if you constantly switch between clamshell mode and laptop mode. Like, for me, I haven't taken my laptop out of the clamshell stand that I have for, like, 3 months or something. Like, ever since I got the iPad Pro, basically, because that's what I've been using whenever I wanted to, like, you know, sit on the couch and work for a little bit, or, you know, in the kitchen or wherever, then I use the iPad now. So yeah, my computer has been in clamshell mode connected to my display that I have, which is a, you know, 27-inch Samsung display, which works really great for me. Like, I don't feel like I need a bigger display. I don't think my non-pro laptop could drive a 6K display.
Probably not.
It can drive the 4K display pretty well, actually. Like, I don't have any issues with that. But I think 6K would be pushing it. So yeah, I think this is a pass for me as well, at least for now. But, you know, we'll see. Maybe in the future it's going to be like, you can't look at 4K anymore. Like, 4K looks like non-retina looks right now. Who knows? Like, maybe our eyes will evolve to to see better retina quality.
Yeah, maybe. And by the way, there's a bug in AirBuddy with external displays. I'm glad you haven't experienced that.
I don't think so, no.
Cool.
All right, so there's been other reports as well since we last recorded, and that's that our good friend Mark Gurman has also had a few new reports. So, Rambo, why don't you tell us about these new rumors about Marzipan and iOS 13?
Yeah, so speaking about the Mac, there's also Marzipan. And I need to do a little PSA here that the name of the project at Apple that makes it possible to run iOS apps on the Mac is, in fact, Marzipan. It is Marzipan. Because I keep reading and hearing on other podcasts, people say, oh, it's not, we're not sure the name is Marzipan. But yes, it is. It's been confirmed 100% by both me, Gurman, and Steve Troughton-Smith.
The unholy trinity.
Yeah, it's all over the code, and the runtime, there are some strings inside some binaries that show that the name of the runtime is Marzipan. So yes, it is Marzipan. So with that out of the way, and I'm sure they are not going to call this Marzipan publicly.
Oh, no. No, I don't think
I
so
hope
either.
They will not, but who knows. But yeah, so according to Gurman, the Marzipan project is like, as he mentioned before, I think since 2017 when he started talking about it, is a multi-phase process at Apple. And the first step was to port some of Apple's own apps, which they did last year, which was a surprise for everyone, I think, because we were all thinking that this Marzipan thing would be only announced this year, but they gave us the sneak peek last year. So this year, what they're doing is they are going to release the SDK for third-party developers. So every developer who's got an iPad app will be able to port that app to the Mac easily. How easily? We don't know for sure. I hope it's pretty easy, and I hope there are tools to like make the experience better on the Mac.
Yeah.
But I expect this to be a checkbox in Xcode.
Right.
Or just like you can do like a checkbox for universal between iPad and iPhone. I do expect it to be that easy.
You don't think it will even be like its own target or its own like... It needs to be its own target, right?
Not necessarily. It can be the same target, but it could be a separate target, yes. But I'm not sure if that's the way they're going to go about it, because a separate target brings more complexity to a project. Like, let's say you have a simple iOS app that doesn't have like frameworks or anything, no extensions, it's just like the app target. If you duplicate the target to make the Mac app, you have to remember to like every new file you add to your project, you need to add to both targets. So I do think it's going to be even easier than that, because it seems like the main goal with this is to make it super easy.
All right. That sounds pretty cool. The reason I'm thinking that there would be a separate target is that there will probably, even though this is a first step with limited capabilities, there will probably be some Mac-specific settings, like what do you want your menu bar to look like, or keyboard shortcuts, or, you know, something that is, you know, added to the app if you compare it to the iPad version.
Yeah, I suspect this will be like right now, if you do an app with storyboards, you can have a main storyboard for iPhone and a separate one for iPad.
Right, yeah. That's a way they could solve it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope that it doesn't require storyboards or zips, because I don't use those.
Right.
but it probably won't. Many Apple's apps don't use it either, so I think we're fine there.
Yeah.
Like the news app, for instance, it is like a super custom UI. As far as I know, it does not use zips or storyboards or anything, and it's present on both platforms. So yeah.
Yeah, no, that would be a weird requirement to have. I mean, it's understandable on, for example, watchOS, the reason they require storyboards, because the UI is like built by the system. Like, we don't have access to the actual underlying UI kit classes. So that makes sense for that platform. But for the Mac and for iOS, like, that's not the case. And, you know, there would be so many apps that would break, because even if you are mainly using storyboards, there are so many apps that use it for like 90% of all the screens, but then for the 10% that is very, very highly customized, they build that UI in code. So even though not everyone is like you and me and builds everything in code, I think that would just be a very strange decision to make for something like this.
Yes, I agree. So, and for the stuff that's different between platforms, there's always like the availability checks, the pound if stuff. So there's always a solution.
Yeah.
Probably if OS, iOS, Mac.
Oh, right. Yeah, like that's that. That's a great OS.
Yeah, iOS, Mac. I'll laugh if they actually call it iOS, Mac publicly, which is another name for this type of port.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the interesting aspect of this latest report from Gurman is that he mentioned that this year only iPad apps will be able to take advantage of this. And what I think he meant by that, or the people who gave him this information meant, is that you need like an either an iPad only app in the App Store, or you're going to need a universal app, which is one that's the same app for both iOS and iPad.
That could just be so that they are able to make more assumptions when doing the actual like underlying conversion, right? Where if you are building your UI for iPad, it already supports like larger screens. And that would presumably make it easier for the system to like make it a windowed application, support full screen, and these kind of things. Like the fact that you've most likely already done that work to make it like fully stretchable, and Marzipan or you know the underlying system can then use that assumption to do a lot of things, like a lot of the heavy lifting on the app's behalf.
Yeah, because iPad apps are already resizable.
So, yeah, exactly.
Especially if you are on like an iPad Pro, you can run two apps side by side and you can slide the little divider and the apps need to be able to handle that. So iPad apps are resizable pretty much, so it should work well on the Mac. An interesting aspect of this, and I think Steve Thornton-Smith brought it up on Twitter, is that many iPhone apps would work pretty well as like a small window on the Mac.
Yeah.
Like, think about like a Twitter client. Not that I would use one like that, but just as an example, like let's say Instagram. Like Instagram would work as like a small window, mm-hmm. I guess. So I'm not sure why they wouldn't allow that. Maybe they think it's too crappy, basically.
Or maybe it's just like a, you know, it's just a scoping issue that just, you know, like I mentioned, they're able to take those apps and make more assumptions about them, because if you also add, you know, more permutations like iPhone apps and all those kind of things, like it just adds complexity, right? So maybe mm-hmm. it's just like a way to say like, let's scope this down. Let's make it as focused and simple as possible. Let's just stick to iPad apps this time around. And then next year we'll add iPhone into the mix. Or maybe they want to wait until like, you know, they have a new UI kit or a new UI API until they bring in the iPhone. You know, there can be many kind of underlying reasons for it.
Yeah. Thinking about it, like those are two separate idioms. So that there's the iPhone idiom and there's the pad idiom.
Yeah.
So maybe like the Marzipan runtime only supports the pad idiom and you can't run iPhone apps on it. Yeah, that makes sense.
So one thing that came to mind I want to ask you is that, you know, on the iPad Pro, when you take Twitter, for example, and you bring it in as a slide over application, or you bring it in as a column, like a single column based application on the side, that will actually make most apps render their iPhone layout. So that will use the compact size class in code to actually just make it look pretty much like a, you know, just very tall iPhone app.
It's kind of like a responsive website, right?
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that Marzipan would work the same way? Do you think that if I resize, let's say that Twitter adds support for this, the main Twitter app, and I would take the window and I would, you know, resize it to be as thin as possible, that the UI would actually work the same way, that it will switch over to the compact size class?
Well, again, friend of the show, Steve Thornton-Smith, he tried it out.
Right.
Yeah, he took the Stocks app and I think he hacked the minimum window size or something. And he was able to scale it down, scale the window down further than it allows. And yes, it rendered the iPhone layout.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't know if that's like a side effect of it not being done, or if it's like the intended behavior.
It would be pretty cool, I think, because like, again, taking Twitter as an example, I think that many people would like to like have a very thin like slice of their window dedicated to something like Twitter or email or iMessage, or, you know, that's how I use iMessage sometimes when I have, when I'm in a lot of conversations, I just, you know, put it as, you know, a very, very thin window on the side. So I think it could be pretty cool to make the UI adapt to that as well, just like on the iPad.
Yeah. And going forward on the report, he also mentioned that by 2021, Apple plans to have apps that are universal between iPhone, iPad, and the Mac, and a single app store for all platforms.
Nice.
So what I think this means is, of course, but I mean, not of course, but probably are Macs. And also that you're going to be able to like put up a single app in the App Store, and that universal is going to mean Mac, iOS, iPhone, and iPads.
Like truly because, universal.
Yeah.
Except for the Apple TV and the Apple Watch.
Yeah. Right now, universal means iPhone and iPad, basically.
Right.
So,
which, it when it came out, was universal, right? That, yeah. Those were the only two app stores.
Yeah, so maybe they're going to change those checkboxes in Xcode to be like iPhone, Mac, and iPad, and you, and maybe there's gonna be like universal and asterisk iPhone and iPad, something like that.
Right, exactly.
So that's very interesting, and it also means like that, and I'm not sure if they would do something like this for the developers, or if the developers would be able to do something like this, but there's like a market issue that currently you can sell an app for iPhone and iPad and a separate app for the Mac, and that's considered normal. Like getting the iOS app does not give you access to the Mac app automatically.
Right.
And this would mean that if you buy the app, you get access to it on every platform. But still developers need to actually do work to support all platforms, even though it would supposedly be easy to support the Mac. Let's say if they want to add like Mac specific features, and there are always going to be like platform specific bugs and stuff you need to work on, so meaning that you're going to have access to all platforms with a single subscription or a single purchase. I don't know how developers are going to feel about it.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of complex equations where, you know, it might mean that more people are going to use your app because they can use it anywhere and it's easy to purchase, it's easy, you know, to subscribe to if it's a subscription. But it could also mean that you would lose revenue because a lot of apps are more expensive on the Mac, and that's kind of the last standing fortress of app pricing, right? On so many other platforms, including mobile and including, you know, on the App Store for iOS, you know, there's been this huge decline in app pricing, and right now you're seeing so many apps move to more subscription-based models and, you know, these kind of free-to-play games and things like that, and on the Mac, that is still kind of not the case. There are some apps that follow the same model, but they are also mostly like these cross-platform apps. Cross-platform, not in the sense of, you know, they're written using Electron, but that they are both on like the Mac and iOS, for example. So yeah, I think it's complex, but it could be a positive change. It could also be like, I think it's also like a little bit inevitable, you know, when you look at it, and that this kind of software pricing thinking that people have gotten used to on mobile would eventually leak into both, like, you know, the Mac and Windows and other desktop platforms, but also like for games, like game consoles, because, you know, you go buy a console game that's like, you know, $60 or something, and you buy the same kind of game, or, you know, the same, let's say the same series or the same franchise on mobile, and sure, it will be a stripped down version, but that will usually be like free to play. So I think it's kind of inevitable that these worlds will start colliding, and we will see a change in how we buy software. And it, You know, in some ways it can be better because it will also probably be easier to distribute, easier to build, but it could also mean that, especially for apps that have relied a lot on that Mac income with that higher pricing, you know, could be challenging.
Yeah, and it's also worth remembering that AppKit is not going away anytime soon. So developers are going to still be able to make Mac-specific versions of their apps or Mac-only apps that take full advantage of the Mac as a platform and provide a better experience, because the Marzipan apps, they can, I believe they will be able to be good at some point, but I still think that going like fully native app kits is the way to go if you want to like make a really great Mac app, especially for like pro apps and productivity apps.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we should say how we are feeling about this. I think we talked about it when they first introduced Marzipan, but is it the same? I mean, I'm still excited about it. I'm excited to see which apps we're going to get. Like, are we going to get like Snapchat on the Mac or anything like that? I am personally very excited to maybe get a Netflix app for the Mac, for instance.
Oh yeah, I would love
which,
that.
Like the iPad app, the Netflix iPad app running on the Mac would be great. Like you can put it full screen, and yeah, I feel like it would be a great fit. Also, like the YouTube app and stuff like that.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Like for all kinds of streaming media.
Are you still excited about it?
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of complaint about the apps that were included in Mojave. And, you know, rightly so. Those apps were a bit weird in many ways, like especially when it comes to like how they use iOS style date pickers or iOS style alerts. And, you know, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that UI, but it's inconsistent with the rest of the Mac, right? And I think that might be the case for a while going forward, that we will see some inconsistencies here and there during a transition phase, right? Where you, if you know what's going on under the hood, you'll be able probably to spot a Marzipan app, you know, pretty easily, even even with a public release, I think. Like, there will be issues like that. But I still think it's a net win, 100%, for the platform. Because, like you say, there's so many apps that could be on the Mac that are not. And, you know, these companies like Netflix, etc., like, they are relying on web apps instead, like their web experiences. And if they could easily bring over their iPad app, that would be a better experience. Because I would love to run, like, native apps for those kind of things. And the iPad apps are great, so why not, right? And I personally like don't see it as like a threat to the Mac experience or whatever, because I still think that there's going to be a big, big group of applications that need to have more advanced controls. Like take something like, you know, Logic or you know, video editing apps, or even something like, you know, Pixelmator, which has more like precise tools and things compared to the iPad version. I think there's still going to be a huge market for those kind of apps. And I don't think Marzipan is necessarily making those kind of apps go away, but it's just enabling, like it's just widening the market and enabling more apps to come to the Mac that weren't there before. So I'm super excited about it.
And hopefully reducing the amount of crappy Electron apps.
Oh, right, yeah. Because
that's like, I don't remember who wrote that, but they're like cancer. It's like eating away.
I think it was you who said it on like the first episode of the show.
It was
someone else.
Are you
quoting yourself now, Rambo?
So, like, imagine if Slack brings their iOS app to the Mac. I would be more than happy to use it instead of the RAM CPU destruction device that their Electron app is. I don't even know if they still use Electron, but it's some cross-platform crap that makes the app terrible.
Right. Yeah, it would probably lead to a better experience for many kinds of apps. So, yeah, I'm happy about it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also looking forward to building stuff with it. So I don't see some developers are being very negative towards this. And, you know, as a developer, I'm excited about stuff like this. Like, it might not be perfect in the beginning, but it will enable me to build new things and build apps in a different way. And that's exciting. So, yeah, I'm all aboard the Marzipan hype train.
I am bringing Chibi Studio to the Mac, definitely.
You heard it here on Stack Trace first.
Yeah. I've done it already.
Yeah,
without
I know.
SDK. I'm also nice. Super excited to like the minute after the keynote ends at WWDC and everyone has the, well, it's not going to be the minute because it takes like half a day to download and install Xcode, but like after everyone has the Xcode 11 beta installed, to start seeing like the screenshots on Twitter of all of the developers running their iOS apps on the Mac, that's going to be so much fun.
All right, Gurman also had some interesting tidbits or interesting rumors about iOS 13, which we want to talk about next. But before we do, let's thank our second and final sponsor. And it's our good friends at Mac Stadium. Mac Stadium is the leading provider of enterprise-grade Mac infrastructure, which allows you to form a really scalable, very reliable, and secure solution for a private cloud and dedicated servers on Mac OS. You might have heard about Mac Stadium both on this show. We've talked about them quite a lot because, you know, Rambo is using them and, you know, they're being used quite a lot in the community for all kinds of server-side things that require Mac OS. But Apple also specifically mentioned them during their last keynote when they announced a new Mac Mini, because with Mac Stadium, you can actually stack a Mac Mini in their data center and have it accessible in the cloud, which is pretty amazing. So whether you need a single Mac Mini or you need a fully scalable Mac private cloud, then Mac Stadium can help you with that. And it can help you move a lot of your workloads that require Mac OS from a Mac Mini that sits under someone's desk and into the cloud. You can scale from a single Mac to thousands very easily. And Mac Stadium, they have over 8,000 Mac Minis racked in their data centers. So your Mac Mini is going to have some good company there in their data centers. You can also work with experts to create your perfect cloud for your needs. And you're also in good company yourself as well, not only your Mac Mini, because you'll be joining companies like Capital One, Shopify, Pandora, and so many others that use Mac Stadium. So you can reduce your costs a lot versus your do-it-yourself solutions. You can get fixed monthly billing, and there are so many advantages to using Mac Stadium for your Mac in the cloud needs. And just a quick aside, Rambo, like, what's your thoughts about Mac Stadium since you're using it yourself?
Yeah, I've been using Mac Stadium for Sharecuts.app and also for the Splash website we made with your library, which uses like Core Graphics and NS attributed string to color Swift code. And yeah, we made that using Vapor and using your Swift code, which links against Core Graphics and AppKit. And since it's a Mac, we can run that on a server in the cloud and make it available as a website and as a service that people can use. So I've been very happy with Mac Stadium, and I'm going to keep my server there for the foreseeable future. It's really fun to have a little Mac on the cloud.
Nice. So if you're building apps for the Apple ecosystem, or if you know a team that is, then you can learn more about Mac Stadium's infrastructure by going to macstadium.com/stacktrace. And if you use that link, macstadium.com/stacktrace, you're also helping support our work with this show as well. But the cool thing is that you also get a great offer, because if you use the promo code 9to5Mac, that is 9to5Mac, when you order, then you will get 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription. Great offer from our good friends at Mac Stadium. So again, check them out at macstadium.com/stacktrace. Thank you so much to Mac Stadium for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. So iOS 13, we're getting closer and closer to WWDC, and it's pretty much a given that we're going to see iOS 13. If they're not going to do the hotel thing and skip room number 13 and they just go to iOS 14. So what has Gurman got in store for us in terms of new iOS 13 rumors?
Dark mode.
I am so surprised.
You're not a dark mode kind of person, are you?
I'm not. I ran dark mode for about 2 minutes and then I switched back. Because the one thing that I don't like about dark mode is that it treats everything, and I understand why. I mean, that's the whole point of dark mode, but it treats everything, you know, as it should be, like a dark surface, even something like a document or an email. And email was the one thing that I just couldn't do. Like,
you know, you can turn that off, right?
Oh, you can. Okay, so then maybe I'll give it a second chance. But I was just like, no, I'm not doing this. Back to light mode we go. Back to the light world. But you're excited about dark mode.
Yes, I am. To be honest, I'm not sure how excited I am about it on iOS. I was definitely very excited for it on the Mac, and I do use it all the time. Like, I never go to light mode. I basically only enable light mode when I'm going to take screenshots for Rambo.codes, because I do both versions.
Yeah, that's a very nice touch.
Theme. Yeah. So that's basically the only time I switch to light mode, and I'm like, oh, this is horrible. And it hurts my eyes. And I even use mail in dark mode.
Yeah, mail in dark mode, I know, I can't do that. but yeah, I mean, I do like it for things like Xcode, and, you know, I usually run dark modes whenever an app offers it itself. Like, for example, IA Writer, which I use for writing all my articles, mostly use that in dark mode and things like that. But yeah, I don't know, like, system-wide dark mode for me, it's... yeah, it's a little bit too dark. I like some light touches in my UIs. So what do you think this is going to mean for us as developers? Like, the Mac implementation of dark mode seems to have been pretty smooth for developers, at least if you were using, like, you know, the built-in theming systems and the NS appearance and things like that. But on iOS, it's like all over the place. Like, people are definitely not only using, like, UI appearance for their styling of their components. Like, it's very, very different there. So do you think this is going to be a little bit harder to roll out, like a system-wide dark mode for iOS? Or do you think maybe it's not going to matter as much because every app is full screen, especially on the iPhone?
I am super curious to see how they're going to handle it, because it's a very different thing on iOS than it is on the Mac. On iOS, you basically, most apps, they customize everything significantly.
Yeah.
It's very rare to see like a vanilla iOS app. Most iOS apps on the store, like significant iOS apps, they have very customized UI. So I expect it on iOS to be more of like a simple on and off kind of thing that the app can listen to and switch its own theme based on that. Like for Chibi Studio 2.0, we have a dark mode, and it's just like an on and off kind of thing. You switch it on, you switch it off, and the entire app, there's no vanilla UI kit in there. Like, every single control is customized based on the app's own theme. So I have a hard time seeing how they would be able to make it automatic for apps on iOS like they've been able to do on the Mac.
Yeah, and it can even generate some kind of like Frankenstein-ish experiences or bugs where, you know, some controls are used in a more vanilla fashion. And one example that comes to mind is like UI button, where, you know, a lot of apps, they use UI button in more or less the default configuration. They might add some, you know, custom border or custom background image or something, but that's like the control they use. Or UI navigation bar is another example where, you know, most apps don't implement their own UI navigation bar.
Yeah, but they do customize it.
Right, they
like,
do. But
for Chibi Studio, we explicitly, like, we change a lot of things about the navigation bar, like the background color, the shadow color, the everything.
Yeah. So
that there's no way they could, like, they would not, like, override the custom background color reset.
Right. No, exactly. So that would be really challenging, right? And yeah. What I'm thinking is, let's say that, you know, in an app I'm working on right now, there is not a custom background color on the navigation bar, but there is a custom tint color for like the navigation bar items and for the title and things like that. So what if that navigation bar would automatically turn dark, right? Like,
yeah,
that would look very, very strange.
Yeah,
so
and
I
that's
think
very common on iOS for like for the app to have like an identity color, like the accent color on Mojave. Like,
yeah,
basically every iOS app has its own. But to the point you mentioned, the Frankenstein problem, it's a little bit hard to happen because of a simple fact that they would not apply the dark stuff to apps that haven't been built with the iOS 13 SDK,
right,
like they've done on the Mac.
Yeah.
So and probably they would add like an infoplist key you could add to like say, please don't mess with my team, just use the default one and I'll handle it.
Yeah.
Because yeah, otherwise it would be like you said, like it would be like parts of an app would be in dark mode and others would not, and it would be terrible.
Yeah, because for example, earlier we talked about setting screens, right? And that's a typical example of where a lot of apps just use a normal like vanilla UI table view controller, just put some items in there, done, right? And it would be very strange if like the rest of the app is like their own color, and then you go to the setting screen and it's all dark.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see how they do it. I don't expect it to be too automatic. I expect it to be more of like, and if you think about it, they could implement it very quote unquote easily by just adding like a global preference to the system, which is it dark or is it light?
Like a boolean, like it just, yeah. Just a static boolean, yeah.
Implement it for their own apps and add like an API to UIKit you can query and get notifications from to like change the theme on your own app. Because these days, I think like most, again, most significant iOS apps, like apps that have a large amount of users and are semi-popular at least, they usually have a dark mode already. Like most apps do. Another thing I was thinking about earlier this week when I thought about this dark mode thing is many apps charge for dark mode. What's
right,
going to happen there?
Feature. Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Are they going to start rejecting apps that charge for dark mode? Because it's in the rules that you can't charge for system features. But if it's just like a on and off kind of thing, like the developer has to do all the work. The system is just helping the developer know about the user's preference. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. I wouldn't be surprised if they only did it for like the system stuff, like Springboard and their own apps, and then like gave the developers just on-off switch kind of thing. I wouldn't be surprised if it was just that.
Another thing that comes to mind that they could potentially do, like they have been building out some interesting infrastructure in regards to theming in the last couple of releases. And you wrote a piece on Rambo.codes about using asset catalogs for theming, right?
Yep.
And that's what I
use for Chibi Studio.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an interesting part because, you know, let's say that you would put your colors in asset catalogs and you would put all that information in there. And then there would be some form of API to say, give me an asset catalog that has been adjusted for dark mode, for example. And then the system could also give you additional information like, you know, the standard background color, like system background color and things like that. And you could then see it like as a pipeline of there's the system colors, the system theme. You apply your own theme on top of that using something like asset catalogs. And then you get like either some like code generation or something like that. You get a nice API that you can use from your views and from your app to get the right colors and the right theme.
Well, that's actually done already because on the Mac, you can have the current system appearance is one of the properties you can set on asset catalog assets,
yeah.
Be them images, colors, etc. So you can just say like, this is a color called background. And for light mode, it's white. And for dark mode, it's black. And
yeah.
When you use the system API, UI color, in the case of the Mac and S color named background, it's going to give you the correct color for the current theme. So that's done.
Yeah, so they could
already use
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that would be pretty
cool. That would be like a good approach. And it is what I'm using for Chibi Studio, but a little bit differently because I don't have the system appearance theme
on iOS. You basically built your own little Boolean inside of that function, I guess.
Yeah, I basically have two different bundles,
and
each bundle has its own asset catalog because the way these APIs that use asset catalogs work is that you have one asset catalog per bundle and you can't like have two different asset catalogs in a single bundle and switch between them. So what I do is I have a bundle for the light theme and a bundle for the dark theme, and I just pick the one that's currently enabled. So yeah, it is doable, but it's definitely not going to be automatic on the Mac. And because of that, I don't expect every single app to work with dark mode. So there's more stuff about this report that we would like to talk about. Like, for instance, Springboard is going away on iPad, and that's a biggie. But we are running out of time, so we are going to talk about it on the next episode.
A little cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, we want to talk about other aspects as well. Like, I've been doing some experiments lately with keyboard support on iPad, so we want to dive a little bit more deeper into that and do a little bit of a iPad focus segment on the next episode. And the good news is that you don't have to wait long for it, because it's going to be next week, because we do the show weekly now, which is so much fun.
Yep.
All right, so that's it for this episode. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we also want to, again, thank our sponsors. We had our good friends at Hyper, where you can go get the new Hyper Juice wireless charging case for AirPods. Make sure to check out the show notes for a link to that. And also Mac Stadium, where you can go to host the Mac Mini in the cloud and have a Mac Mini subscription. You can get 2 months for the price of one, and you can check that out at macstadium.com/stacktrace. You can also find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell, and you can find Mr. Rambo at _inside. But that's it for this week, so say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.